Ensuring your baby gets the nutrients they need to support their growth and development is a top priority for every parent. That's why millions around the globe have turned to A2 Platinum as the formula they trust. A2 Platinum Premium Infant Formula is nutritionally complete with whole milk as the first ingredient. Their A2 whole milk comes from specifically selected cows that naturally produce milk containing only the A2 protein and no A1. With 30-plus select nutrients, A2 Platinum is specifically designed with tiny tummies in mind and without worry of harmful chemicals. Quality and safety are the number one priority for A2 Platinum. Plus, they are clean label Project Purity Award certified. Join millions of parents and choose A2 Platinum for your little one. Right now, for a limited time only, A2 is offering podcast listeners 25% off their first purchase when you use promo code PODCAST25 at checkout on Amazon or at A2Platinum.com. Again, for 25% off your first order, go to Amazon or A2Platinum.com and use the promo code PODCAST25.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writing excuses. Season 19, Episode 51. This is Writing Excuses.
And that was that.
15 minutes long.
Because you're in a hurry.
And we're not that smart.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Howard.
So we're going to talk a little bit about endings and how you have your big moment of climactic excitement and then how you wrap it all up for your reader. And when I started thinking about this, I was really thinking about fantasy fiction, because I feel like in fantasy, the world like often changes in these very big, dramatic, like big ways. And then you have to make sense of all of that and still bring it back to something that hits home for the reader. So I'm wondering, how y'all do that?
Well, earlier this month, we talked about Toy Story, and Toy Story does this wonderfully. You know, that birthday scene at the beginning where they're all freaking out. Oh, no, we're going to get a new toy. How is it going to disrupt our status quo? We get that exact scene at the end, but we get it instead of we need to see if Buzz Lightyear is the new toy. And instead it is Buzz Lightyear is my best friend and we're working together to see what the next toy is going to be. And what this is doing, and what I try to do in my writing, is compare the end to the beginning. It doesn't have to be a let's go back to the Shire and see how we've changed, that mythological return to home kind of idea. It can just be something that reminds us of the beginning, but shows that it has changed, recontextualizes it, sees it from a different perspective, so that we can go, oh, okay, things have changed. A doesn't exactly equal A anymore because we've added B to it.
I find that I do the very similar thing, that I try to look for those resonance moments. I often think about it as doing like the beginning and inverse. And at the beginning of a story, a novel, you're attempting to ground the reader, you know, with who, where, what, why do I care? And at the end, I find that I actually also need to hit those beats again. That I need to let people know who we are with, like how my character has changed, who they are now, where we are. Sometimes it's a literal different place, but also like what the environment is. And then the reason to care, it's like, why is this important to my character? And giving some aspect of interiority to the character really helps for me, like bring that sense of, oh, we're home, this is the return. Even in stories where it's not unhappily ever after, but this is the moment.
I'm a big fan of the surprising yet inevitable. And if I have to choose between surprising and inevitable, I will choose inevitable because that lets the reader feel smart. If I choose surprising but non sequitur, then I often just make the reader angry. And so, am I always clever enough to surprise the reader? No, frankly, I'm not. So I look at surprising yet inevitable as the high bar and reach for inevitability first.
When I think about authors who are famously bad at endings, or at least people complain about their endings a lot. So the safest one to mention is Stephen King, for example, right? People hate Stephen King's endings, especially in his earlier novels. The thing that I notice about those is that they end abruptly. They don't give space for the denouement, to use the fancy term for it, right? That beat past the declining action where we get to see the characters entering their new status quo. The reason I think that that is so unsatisfying, right? And I think you guys are talking about really excellent points in terms of closing those parentheses, referring back to the initial moments. But also, as the reader, I want my candy now, right? Like, I've eaten the full meal, but I do want dessert at this point. I want that last bite to leave with that gives me a sense of this was all worth it, right? And sometimes that bite is a reward of, like, seeing the happy ending for them, right? And to go to Lord of the Rings, Samwise Gamgee getting married, having a good time. That is the candy for Sam. For me, also, the candy is Frodo having to leave the Shire because he's too traumatized, right? Because that's the thing that tells me this journey meant something. It was so weighty and so difficult that poor, sweet Frodo is shattered at the end of it, right? And to me, that makes so much of the arc of the whole story feel so heavy and rich and bountiful to me because I had that emotional moment at the end. People complain all the time that Lord of the Rings has four endings. I think it's important that it has each of those endings. It tells us that this, I spent the last however many months of my life reading these massive books or however many hours watching these movies, that I did something worthwhile because the writers took me seriously enough to make sure that I felt good at the end of it.
And this is something that I had a hard time with when I transitioned from writing short stories to novels, mm-hmm. is that I would hit the landing and I'd get out and I wouldn't give the audience time to breathe and to have that candy. I love that metaphor of the way to describe it. One of the things that I see people do who are historically bad at endings, in addition to the end now we just stop, is that they will introduce a new question, a new problem. And this is very tempting to do all the time, especially, I think, with fantasy. It's like, but what about the other dragon? And, you know, and it's like, because that's, you know, you're gearing up for a sequel. And not every book has to have a sequel. And often, if you do that, it doesn't feel like the book's ended. Mm-hmm. So trying not to introduce a new story question at the end, trying not to, like, ramp the tension up as you're heading towards the end. So the trick that I've found for myself is that I write that last chapter, my denouement, my epilogue, I kind of write it as a standalone short story with the same characters and on the same theme.
Mm-hmm. There are bazillion different structures that we could be working within. And primarily when I talk about satisfying readers, I'm talking about satisfying myself and my own familiarity with structures that are primarily Western. And so within those structures, I try to make sure that for the first after I hit 2/3 of the book, I'm not allowed to introduce new characters, new technologies, new settings, knew anything, because I don't want to do that exact thing, Mary Robinette. I don't want to drop a big fat question at the end, and I don't want to drop something that feels like a deus ex machina. The last third of the book, I have to use the toys that I put on the table in the first 2/3. And for me, for the structures and genres that I work within, that's pretty effective for forcing me to narrow my options for an ending.
Well, I think it's important to remember that there is a difference between an open-ended ending and a cliffhanger ending. Mm-hmm. Look at the first Star Wars movie. We know when the Death Star goes down that the Empire is much bigger than this. We know that Darth Vader is still alive. But because of the order in which they present that information to us, we end on an incredibly final, satisfying note. It doesn't feel like a stretch to keep telling this story in more movies. But also, we're not left with lingering questions. There's no last-minute stinger scene of Darth Vader tumbling in his TIE fighter, and we go, dun-dun-dun, he's still alive. We already know that, because that was given to us during the climax. And so you can have these kinds of things. You just need to end us on that moment that helps us feel resolved and satisfied.
This actually reminds me of something we said all the way back when we were talking about beginnings, which is about building reader trust by asking questions and then answering them. And I think there's a little bit of that in the end too. Like, you want to make sure you've answered enough questions in this book that if you raise like one additional, not raise, but if there's an additional piece of information out there, there's more to the world, it feels as if the reader still got the questions that they had for this book answered, and that they trust that you will answer those questions, like, in the future. I will say that, like, as a, I am, people who are horrible at endings, it me. So I, like, one of the things that I do that's a, like, an in-between mistake is the shove everything in the closet. So this is like you're cleaning your room and you get to the point where you've taken a lot of things out because you were organizing everything, but it looks really bad at that moment. You're like, oh gosh, everything is everywhere. And you could put things in the new places you've put for them, or you could all shove it in a closet and then like close the door. And so sometimes when things feel like they've ended, when I've written endings and I'm like, this feels unsatisfying, it's because there are things I just didn't want to deal with. Like, I was like, I just didn't really want to answer how they got to this place. And so I just decided to ignore it.
In Act One, you hang a snow shovel and a trash compactor on the mantle and everything will fit in the closet in Act Three.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of unsatisfying endings, I think we need to go to break for a couple minutes and then we will be right back.
Hey, friends. The 2025 retreat registration is open. We have two amazing writing retreats coming up, and we cordially invite you to enroll in them. For those of you who sign up before January 12th, 2025, how is that even a real date? We're off.
Friend.
As you can probably hear my cat say, we've got a special treat for our friends. We're offering a little something special to sweeten the pot. You'll be able to join several of my fellow Writing Excuses hosts and me on a Zoom early bird meet and greet call to chit-chat, meet fellow writers, ask questions, and get even more excited about Writing Excuses retreats. To qualify to join the early bird meet and greet, all you need to do is register to join a Writing Excuses retreat, either our Regenerate retreat in June or our annual cruise in September 2025. Just register by January 12th. Learn more at writingexcuses.com/retreats.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chance of Sennar is one of my favorite games that I've played in the last year. And I'm not the only one. It was nominated for the Nebula Award for game writing. So it is a great experience for anyone. Here's what happens. You basically show up in a tower and people are speaking to you and it's like, wah, 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 wah. You're just seeing symbols and you have to figure out from context what their words mean. And that's what the gameplay is. You're figuring out, oh, okay, murmur means plant and blah, 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 blah means upstairs. And you're figuring it out and you're putting it together. And then you move to another level where people are saying, whatever. They're using a completely different language and whatever it is. And you have to figure out that one. And then you have to figure out how to understand what each of these different levels people are doing, what their language is, and figure out that like click clock in one language means rah, rah, in another, and bring people together through puzzle solving and language. It's amazing. The art is great. The music is great. And if you've ever thought, hey, writing can unite people, wild, this is a game that I know that you will love. So check out Chance of Sennar.
Okay, so we were talking about this a little bit before the break, but I was wondering if we could talk about cliffhangers more specifically, right? Because I think there's a specific art to ending on big open questions leading into book two, leading into book three, whatever it is, but still giving readers a sense of completion, right? I was thinking, I rewatched the second Spider-Verse movie the other day, which ends on an incredible cliffhanger. But also, when I watch that movie, I have such a satisfying sense of completion because questions were answered about the characters. Things were closed off about, you know, Gwen Stacy started here, she ends here. Miles starts here, Miles ends here. So how do you get characters to a sense of conclusion while the overall plot clearly is still hanging open and there are huge questions about what's going to happen to these people?
I think I love the Spider-Verse as an example, for one thing, because it's just a great movie.
It's incredible.
But also, it reminded me that there are different types of questions. And I think sometimes we forget that there are character questions and relationship questions that we're asking that are different than plot questions or world questions. Mm-hmm. And so I think figuring out what the core is of the story, like going back and looking at the beginning, what was the promise you were making? I feel like Spider-Verse, for example, is a movie that promises that there's going to be an emotional and character development. And since it delivers that and answers some of those questions, I don't care as much about the very dangling plot questions that are going to be answered in the next movie.
Yeah, for me, a lot of this comes down to making sure that you really know what your story is about. For example, and this is a very thin example. I'm sure I could think of better ones if I tried. But Fellowship of the Ring, the movie in particular, ends on this. Well, and now we're out of time. Please come back next year. But that's the plot. Emotionally, what most of this story has been about is Frodo trying to decide, is he in control of his own destiny, and is he willing to put other people in danger? And that emotional plot conflict gets resolved very solidly at the end when he's like, yes, I am in control. No, I won't put anyone else in danger. I'm going to go do this myself. And so from that perspective, it does feel done and satisfying because we have tied off a major thread, even though there's clearly many others. And so, and Fellowship, I think, is an example where they could have tied that off better if that had been a priority for them. But making sure that you know what this story is actually about. I just watched a really wonderful movie called Polite Society, which is a Pakistani-British action comedy thing about sisters. And these two sisters start off best friends, and then this huge rift shows up, and it ends up with this giant, like, martial arts punch-out. And they defeat the villain, and a lesser movie would end there. And this movie remembered, nope, this is a story about sisters. And so we get that breathing room denouement at the end where they are back together, best friends, doing the things they used to do. And that lets us know that the real story is over.
Yeah, I will surprise no one. So the mice quotient. but the mice quotient is a very useful tool for thinking about these and categorizing them. And so sometimes what I will do at the end is I will sit down and look, okay, I started with an event story and then I've got a character story. Most of my middle is actually spent in a milieu and then I wrap that up. But then I still have my event and character that I have to wrap up at the end. And I will often make a plan to go back and revise the beginning. So I'm opening things in different orders. But at the end, going back to something Dan said earlier about the order in which you present the information to the reader, that what I think about most when I'm doing these endings is what emotion do I want the reader to walk away with? If you think of it like a drug, what is the lingering effect? Like you put up with a bunch of side effects, but there's this one long-term effect that you want. What is that one long-term effect? And so for cliffhangers, the long-term effect that I want is, but what happens next? Mm-hmm. And so that's the beat that I'm going to land on at the very, very end. And if I don't want that cliffhanger, but what happens next, then I'm either going to not raise that question at all, or I am going to put it earlier so that the beat of, oh, I feel good about these characters and they seem healthy right now.
We have talked so much this year about establishing shots, but we haven't really talked about this kind of resolving shot, the satisfying shot at the end. How do you want, what promise do you want to make at the beginning, but then what emotion do you want to leave them with at the end? I think that's a really smart thing to think about. And I'm going to call it a resolving shot.
That's great. I'm going to coin that and copyright it right now.
one of the questions I ask myself when I'm writing an ending, and I ask myself this question because I'm the sort of person who consumes a thing and then immediately does what I'm going to get to in a moment. And that is, where will the reader's headcanon take them after they read the last line? What's the story they are automatically going to try to tell themselves next? I don't control that. They're going to take what I wrote, and then they're going to, if I don't write an ending, they're going to write their own ending. If I write an ending they don't like, they're going to email me. But what is the headcanon that I want to leave them with? And often that, using that as the framing for the resolving shot, you know, that's the cowboys riding off into the sunset. Well, you know, there's another Silverado down the road that will need their help. And that's the headcanon that we get for that kind of a thing.
I'm wondering, in setting up the sort of resolving shot, how do you know? I think that we've been assuming that you know exactly the feeling that you want to end with. But what if you're not sure? Is there anything you can look to sort of in your writing so far in order to figure out what is the best way to end things? What is the thing that will satisfy the reader and yourself as the writer?
For young writers, and when I say young, I mean writers who are new to writing, what are the things that you read that you liked the way it made you feel? Model your writing on the feeling map of those things, and that's a great place to start. For writers who are more advanced, you already have a million techniques that are better than anything I can tell you. Just write.
Yeah, I mean, really, it is digging down to what is the emotional thing that you want to leave, right? Like, what's the thing that will make your reader feel the book in their body when you leave them with it? Because that's the thing they're going to be most excited about. So if you're me, how do you make them as sad as possible in the last scene, right? Or, you know, in the case of Spider-Verse, you know, ending on a beat that is so exciting, everyone's jumping out of their chairs and yelling, right? Like, it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. But I think leaning into the genres of the body is the way to go for those last beats, making them laugh, making them cheer, making them cry. Those are the kind of things, or make, you know, feeling a saccharine sweetness, right? I think that's when you want to leave that lingering taste. Think about how do you do it with this kind of intensity.
Yeah, and I want to say that feeling it in the body is really the key, because sometimes I will see writers say, I want them to think, that was a really clever twist, and it's like that's not
an emotion.
That's a beat in a moment. And it's not something that lingers with you. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you necessarily feel in your body. Sometimes, you know, but that writer was clever. It's like that's not a useful goal.
Yeah, surprising and inevitable is not satisfying if it doesn't also have the body shot accompanying it.
Horror movies end on that last jump scare because they want you feeling bad and nervous as you walk to your car when you leave the theater. They want you to be afraid as you leave, because that is going to be the thing you remember about that movie. If you feel that way, then you're going to get home and be like, yo, you got to watch this movie. I was so scared the whole time. Even if you're only scared in the last 10 minutes of it, right?
So. And one of the things that you can do if you're, you know, we've talked about looking at other media that you consume. But the other thing really simple is you can make yourself a playlist.
Yeah.
That encapsulates the moods that you want. And if you listen to a song, you're like, that is what I want my book to feel like. A lot of times it's because you're feeling that song in your body, and you can start to reach for what are the tools that I can use. Some of the tools that we talked about earlier when we were talking about character, some of the tools that were coming out of language. Those are all tools that you can use to manipulate that last moment. And yes, manipulate your reader so that they have that body feeling.
Think about mood boards, think about playlists, those kind of things.
And
are great.
What I love about all those is we talked earlier about looking at the beginning and then look at the beginning and the ending. And I love that because I'm thinking on my playlist, maybe I want to re-listen to that first song that got me excited at the very end, because that reminds me of the feeling that brought me into the story. And that's maybe the feeling that I want my reader to have going out of it. And with that, I have your homework for the week, which is going to be to think of how your story, how your novel, how what you've been writing this month is going to end. Think of the first ending you can think of, and then think, what might be the next scene, and write that. And then the very last thing that we want you to do is to celebrate yourself. Because no matter where you started, no matter where you end up, you have tried something really difficult this month, and we're really excited for you, proud of you, and really want to see whatever story that you have, and can't wait to read it.
This is writing excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Have you ever wanted to ask one of the Writing Excuses hosts for very specific, very you-focused help? There's an offering on the Writing Excuses Patreon that will let you do exactly that. The private instruction tier includes everything from the lower tiers, plus a quarterly one-on-one Zoom meeting with a host of your choice. You might choose, for example, to work with me on your humorous prose, engage Dong Wan's expertise on your worldbuilding, or study with Aaron to level up your game writing. Visit patreon.com/writingexcuses for more details.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Aaron Roberts, Dan Wells, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.